This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, professor of television studies at Rowan University. Richard Lewis, the veteran stand-up comedian whose routines were full of caustic takes on love, life, and physical and mental health, died of a heart attack Tuesday. He was 76 years old. Richard Lewis was born in Brooklyn in 1947 and made his first appearance as a stand-up comic on stage in Greenwich Village in 1971. It took him 8 years to get on television, and he and TV were an uneasy fit. His one starring role was in the late 80s and early 90s, playing Marty Gold opposite Jamie Lee Curtis in the ABC sitcom Anything But Love. Here's a quick scene featuring the two. His mother is visiting, he's avoiding her, and Jamie Lee's character is trying to get the two to reconcile.
She's your mommy.
I know.
Just spend some time with her, talk with her, listen to her. Let her tell you about her business.
Look, the only time we were ever alone together without fighting is when she was pregnant with me. And even then, I came out screaming.
That series lasted 4 seasons. But before, after, and sometimes during those years, Richard Lewis worked hard to maintain a high profile. He performed in a series of popular stand-up TV specials over the years, and their titles alone reflected the confessional, complaining territory Lewis had carved out for himself. Some of his TV specials and comedy tours were titled I'm Exhausted, I'm Doomed, and The Magical Misery Tour. And all the time he was touring, Lewis was embraced and showcased by some of the most respected and influential comedians in show business. David Letterman had Richard Lewis on his late-night show more than any other guest.
I've lived here all my life. I come back for the show, and I'm going to go back, and I got a call today. I mean, a guy called me up at the hotel because, you know, you publicize where we're staying, which is great. Mm-hmm. And this guy was angry at me. It used to be a game, Prisoner Ball, in second grade. We used to just try to, it was really a sadistic game. We used to try to.
Prisoner Ball?
Yeah, just kill as many people on the other side. That's pretty much it. And he was angry at me. You know, if people harbor these little incidents in their lives, I have thousands of them. And this guy, I'm sure he's in therapy about it now, but he chose to call me. Good luck on the Letterman show. And then he says, I hated you. I hated you for that. So that's the kind of mood I'm in. Just that call happened about an hour ago.
Mel Brooks cast him as Prince John in his 1993 movie, Robin Hood, Men in Tights. And Larry David, a childhood friend, cast Richard Lewis as an even more acerbic version of himself in the first episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm in 1999, a show on which he's appeared off and on ever since, including earlier this month in a scene where Richard and Larry are riding a golf cart, chatting while driving to the next tee.
I did Wordle again today. I'm a Wordle wizard, man. I did it in 3 tries. That's 3 days in a row, man.
Wow, you're really on a good streak.
I'm on a huge streak, that's right.
All right, let's see if I can continue my streak.
I know, you've been unbelievable. What is this all about? How are you doing this?
You know why? I sat on a bench this morning and overheard a lesson. So I've had thousands of hours of lessons. 2 minutes on that bench, this guy changed my life.
What kind of tips?
Vertical drop.
Yeah.
Horizontal tug.
Horizontal tug?
Vertical drop. Horizontal tug. Now, I've dropped before, but I've never tugged. And now I'm tugging.
Maybe I should tug.
You gotta tug.
Can you teach me how to tug?
I'll teach you how to tug.
This is fantastic.
Can I tell you something?
Sure.
I think this is the happiest I've ever been in my life.
I don't even know who I'm looking at right now.
How is something good happening to me?
No one on the planet would believe that you're happy.
How is this possible?
Terry Gross spoke with Richard Lewis twice. The first time was in 1988 to talk about his new HBO comedy special, I'm Exhausted. It combined his live performance on stage in Chicago with his offstage depiction of a nervous breakdown.
Thank you. I just, you're a great audience. I wish I could feel better about feeling good, quite frankly. I'm a hypochondriac. My grandparents, they lived in a place that made me so out of it in Florida. I think the condo was called Crestfawn. That was the name of it, you know. So I feel, you know, and they bought me little gifts. I mean, well, they were very negative. We had like a little depression fair in the backyard for my birthday, and we used to throw wooden hoops around. Prescription drugs was a big thing. And they had No Tomorrowland, which is sort of a big thing, and Pin the Blame on the Donkey was a major game in our house.
How did the I'm Exhausted show come about? Do you go around saying to friends all the time, oh God, I'm exhausted?
I said that actually, I think, to my mother moments after I was born. I just have always been exhausted for the fear that I wouldn't do enough work. Well, that's a whole other area, isn't it? Now, I don't always go around saying I'm exhausted. I'm a good friend. If I went to a funeral, I wouldn't be insensitive and say, yeah, I'm exhausted. I had been exhausted prior to doing this special for HBO. But the problem was the special had to be done in about 2 weeks. And that was like, this should have been an episode of Nova, you know. How a Jewish man with bad posture who searches for perfection is told by executives that, fine, but we have to have it delivered in 2 weeks. And, you know, we pulled it off, I think. I don't know. But I was exhausted doing it, and I think it shows. But in a positive, affectionate way.
Did you enjoy being sick when you were a kid?
Well, I did because I usually wasn't. And but people did. It was like a hypochondriacal kabuki theater I put on for the family. And I had different makeups for different ailments, of course. The flu, I felt, was the dead giveaway. I mean, it was this kabuki, very white makeup. And it was almost a mask-like effect. And it was frightening. I was half a bison, half a Jewish man. And it was, I come down to breakfast knowing that my family would shriek and then have me stay home. And they normally did.
Are you a hypochondriac now?
Yes, sadly.
What are the diseases you most often think you're getting?
Well, I would say mostly, and not to make light of diseases because they're so horrific, and certainly the sexual stuff now is so frightening. I basically get worried when I see any kind of rash, even if the slightest rash, I feel it will eventually spread into just cover me like Elephant Man. And I run to every salve store. There's a lot of salve boutiques in Los Angeles, thank God. And I have a rash man in Beverly Hills who I like. But basically, it's rashes that scare me more than anything. And also, any kind of back pain, I always fear. And I always did as a kid, sadly. Whenever I got a sore throat, for example, I really felt it would never go away. This was when I should have known then that psychotherapy was right around the corner.
Do you ever have audiences who are so well-adjusted that they don't get your jokes about neuroses?
I don't like to consider any audience well-adjusted, seriously. I don't like to judge people. And I certainly wouldn't judge people in that light. I don't find too many people are well-adjusted, and if there were, I wouldn't go over very well. If I ever bomb, thank God I don't bomb as much as you do when you start out, I would just blame myself.
You've done the David Letterman show a lot of times. How many times do you keep count?
I thought it was somewhere in the high 30s, you know.
Do you prepare for it when you go on?
In unbelievable fashion. It's the only reason why I have done stand-up in the last 6 years, or have given me impetus to do it, and because I never had an audience before, like on a regular basis. So I write down thousands and thousands of jokes a month. It takes me days and days to whittle it down to 30 or 40 ideas that I want to get to the show. Not to mention we ad-lib a lot on the show, too, but I prepare in an enormous fashion for the show.
And I feel I had a problem sexually. I felt, ever since I grew up, I just, and we broke up, she was saying that she's bad-mouthing me to my pals.
Oh, is that right?
She said, I gave her an anti-climax, she was telling my friends. And I couldn't even,
that
I
could be dangerous,
oh, we couldn't even
couldn't
have foreplay. She wore like a Rufix bra when she came into the bedroom. And I blame my family. My parents, I know they made love, and yet it was like Nixon, like Watergate. They would cover it up.
Very, very, quiet
well, they,
about
they,
it.
They
yeah.
didn't want to let us hear
sure.
that they were
oh,
screaming.
Yeah.
My father would go, that's gin. He would say, that's gin.
Doesn't Letterman strike you as a pretty healthy, well-adjusted guy?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. Again, I hate to judge people's good health. I'll say this. I think so. I mean, he was such night and day together. I mean, why I think the chemistry has been effective for him and me. When I sit next to him, and I talk about my innermost feelings and certainly sexuality, I look in his face. He's only a foot away from me, and it makes me laugh because I'm not doing this to make him embarrassed, but he does get I feel legitimately embarrassed, and it's cute to me. But his eyes start to recede. They go back like to the Panama Canal. I can't even see his face. It's like a little off in Annie's eyes.
Can I ask you what your bar mitzvah was like? And here's why I ask it. For a lot, I mean, a bar mitzvah is, in Jewish terms, it's a religious ceremony to mark the beginning of manhood. It's just, but for a lot of people, it's like their first opening act, you know, like the first initiation into show business. Because, like, you're the star of the show. There's a band. There's an MC. You know, everybody in your family gets to dance and everything. And you're the star. Was it like a what kind of bar mitzvah did you have?
Spielberg could not have done justice to what I had. First of all, my father, who's passed on, was the greatest caterer in the area, New Jersey and in parts of New York. He was really a genius. So, of course, he catered my bar mitzvah. It got off on a low self-esteem note that my father was booked up on the weekend for my bar mitzvah. I had to settle for a Tuesday afternoon.
Are you kidding?
Early evening bar mitzvah party. Unheralded in the Torah. I mean, I heard Moses grumbling, "How can he do that to his son?" Rah! But what happened was, I understood. You know, he had a job to do, and Tuesday night was sort of hip. Now that I think of it, but before the party, I had to the Saturday before I had to read what they call the Haftorah or Haftorah. I'm very bad with the accents here, but. What happened was that I started screwing up a little bit, and I saw some of the congregation getting a little uneasy, and then I started doing stand-up. I went, "Oh, I'm kidding, Jonah and the Whale, come on." And I started playing the temple like a lounge.
Richard Lewis speaking to Terry Gross in 1988. Terry Gross spoke with him again in the year 2000 when he had just published his memoir, The Other Great Depression, in which he wrote about his struggles with alcohol, drugs, and depression. His father died when he was young, and Terry asked him if his mother was able to accept his comedy about his parents.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, my mother had a great sense of humor, and I'm not mean-spirited. I can really say that. And my comedy, when I talk about other people, it's, you know, the craft of comedy is, you know, hyperbole certainly is a big part of it. And I would exaggerate, but always the truth. And she would be the first to admit, at least privately, that she would do that. You know, I mean, I remember a joke I wrote like 30 years ago, and I use this because it was very economical, and I'm sort of proud of the joke because it was a good joke. It was about how bored I would be driving across country with my family, and how unspontaneous they would be, and how it would drive me crazy. And I, of course, I embellished it. We never did drive across country, but I had us backing out of our driveway from our hometown in Englewood, New Jersey, driving to San Francisco, and her jiggling something in her hand. I said, "Mother, what is that? What are you doing? You're making me crazy." And she says, "I have the tolls ready for the Golden Gate Bridge." And that to me was, you know, would have basically, and the audiences always screamed at that because, you know, I had to set it up properly, but that was like, you drive with this family for 3,300 miles. You know, that's where it was at. And when I would say something that would really hit home, she would never get angry. In fact, she would sometimes call me at the hotel in New York and say, "Don't forget to mock me tonight on Letterman." You know what I mean? So I think she had a love-hate thing with it, you know?
Yeah, when you talk about your neurosis, I can relate to some of that and say, yeah, no, that's really funny, and maybe I'll feel a little bit better about myself. So are you going to feel better about yourself if I laugh at your jokes about
Absolutely.
Your neuroses?
I really do feel validated, you know, that I'm not alone. There's no question I feel less alone. I mean, there's nothing worse when I try to, you know, have a riff on stage about a problem that's making me depressed, and I'm looking at an audience, be it 300 or 3,000, and there's silence. I'm saying, wow. I mean, there's a thin line between narcissism and entertainment, and that's pure narcissism, you know, and you really try to, you know, my goal is to entertain people, but if I can entertain them and get laughs to boot and applause about problems that I'm having, it only means, like what you just said, that, you know, they can relate, and that's my goal.
Well, the last thing you want to do is to share your problems on stage in a way that you think is really funny, and instead of people laughing, they feel sorry for you. Has that ever happened to you?
Yes. Once I said, you know, I'm not a complainer, and 3,000 people moaned. I mean, if there was a trap door in that concert hall, I would have gone down it.
your comedy has always been about, well, yourself and neurosis, right, and hypochondria, et cetera. How did you know when you started in comedy that you were going to be your subject matter and that your insecurities were going to be what your comedy was about?
Well, you know, when I started out in like 71, you know, a lot of comedy was, you know, observational comedy. And, you know, one of the reasons I went on stage is because I felt, you know, very alienated. You know, I didn't get the kind of nurturing that I felt. I just didn't feel nurtured and appreciated as much as probably I wanted to. So I needed the adulation from strangers, really, from audiences. And when I was starting to, I started writing jokes before I went on stage for, as they say, these Catskill comedians and Borschtbelt comedians. And they were rejecting most of the good stuff. And most of the good stuff was my real feelings about myself. And that was a real sign that, you know, I had to go on stage and do these jokes rather than throw them out. And they were about me. And plus, I didn't really like, I felt so judged growing up that I didn't really like to get on stage and tell audiences, you know, did you ever notice this? Did you ever notice when you do that, that you feel this way? That was the last thing I wanted to do. What I wanted to do was talk about how I was feeling and pray to God that it was relatable and that people laughed. And you know, three decades later, they still are mostly. So I guess I struck a nerve.
Richard Lewis speaking to Terry Gross in 2000. The stand-up comedian and frequent Curb Your Enthusiasm guest star died Tuesday. He was 76 years old. Here's another clip from an early stand-up routine.
I mean, I don't mind being with the family on Hanukkah, because being on the road, like I was in the Deep South about 2 years ago on Hanukkah, they thought Hanukkah was a duck call. That's all I know. It was like, Hanukkah, pull, shoot. That's all, you know. I tiptoed around the Deep South on Hanukkah. I just want a sandwich. I'll be fine. Just let me have a sandwich. But Hanukkah, Christmas, we didn't know what we were, quite frankly. It was sort of a... I really don't know what we were. We had like a... There was a Christmas tree, and yet it was a Hanukkah bush. It was sort of like a... Sort of like an elephant man kind of thing there. It was like... They had balls hanging down, and yet there was like a picture of Golda Meir sort of over here. It wasn't Hanukkah. It wasn't Christmas. It was Chronicah. We had Chronicah.
After a break, film critic Justin Chang reviews the long-delayed science fiction sequel, Dune, Part 2. This is Fresh Air.